Syrian military says its air defenses have confronted an Israeli missile attack, intercepting most of the missiles over the capital, Damascus. Israeli troops kill a Palestinian youth and injure 15 others in the Gaza Strip on the sixth night of protests against the siege of the Palestinian territory. Also ahead, Hurricane Ida's remnants unleash severe flooding across the U.S. Northeast, killing at least 45 people in six states. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story for this hour, Syrian media say the country's air defenses have repelled an Israeli attack over the sky of the capital, Damascus. Syrian sources have reported that around midnight, an Israeli air aggression from southeast Beirut targeted some areas in the vicinity of the city of Damascus. Syrian air defense system intercepted most of the missiles. 2 weeks ago, the Syrian army confronted an Israeli attack on the cities of Damascus and Homs. The strike drew strong criticism from both Syria and Lebanon. Syria called on the UN to fulfill its responsibility by taking firm measures to prevent more Israeli attacks against the country. Lebanon also filed a complaint with the world body against Israel for its repeated violations of Lebanese airspace. Political commentator Robert Fantina says the United Nations should take measures to put an end to Israel's violations of Lebanese and Syrian airspace and their sovereignty.
Well, it's very true that the United Nations is neglecting its duty, blatantly neglecting its duty, because it certainly needs to act against this. Israel is continually violating the airspace of Lebanon and Syria, and these attacks in Syria are completely unwarranted. They are not in any way defensive. Syria does not pose any threat to Israel. They are criminal. They are violations of international law. They must be stopped, and it's up to the UN to do it, and the UN is simply not acting. One of the many things that apartheid Israel and racist United States have in common is their complete disdain for international law. Each is a rogue nation. Each feels it can do whatever it chooses, that other nations have to abide by international law, but they are exempt. This is a philosophy that has caused untold suffering around the world for decades and decades and continues to. These are two countries that need to be brought under control. The United Nations needs to begin issuing sanctions and taking action against them.
Syria has called on international institutions to force Israel to stop violating the rights of the citizens in the occupied Golan Heights. The Syrian Foreign Ministry made the plea in letters to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights and the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva. The ministry urged the institutions to intervene immediately to facilitate the return of the Golan residents to their homes. Parts of the Golan Heights have been under Israeli occupation since 1967. The international community, including the United Nations, recognizes Syria's sovereignty over the region. The Deputy Permanent Representative of Iran to the United Nations has called for the adoption of a non-discriminatory approach to the elimination of chemical weapons. Zahra Irshadi said Tehran fully supports the Chemical Weapons Convention and demands global compliance with the treaty. She added that for the world to achieve that goal, Israel must join the convention immediately and without any preconditions. The Iranian envoy hailed Syria for its efforts to completely and quickly destroy its chemical weapons. She expressed regret over what she called the politicization of Syria's case by some countries. Irshadi made the remarks during a UN session on developments in West Asia. Israeli troops have killed a Palestinian youth and injured 15 more near the buffer zone in the Gaza Strip on the sixth night of protests against the siege of the Palestinian territory. The Palestinian Health Ministry said 26-year-old Ahmed Saleh died after Israeli forces shot him in the abdomen. The ministry added that five children among the injured. Three people have been killed and dozens of others wounded since anti-Israel protests began at the weekend. Israeli forces have violently attacked Palestinians protesting against the Israeli blockade. Demonstrators say they will continue their protests until the regime lifts the siege. The territory has been under a tight Israeli air, land, and sea blockade since 2007.
As an example of popular resistance, Palestinians held several rallies on Thursday along the separation fence. There were huge night confrontations, and Palestinians called for a complete lifting of the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip as a result of the continuous gathering by the borders that has been going on for almost 2 weeks. The Israeli regime began to submit to the Palestinian pressure as a list of Palestinian demands has been implemented.
Israel's new measures and facilities are not coming for the favor of the Palestinian side as much as they come to prevent the Palestinian outrage and try to restore peace by the border. Israel is afraid of these gatherings that represent the popular resistance resulted from the deteriorating life Gazans are living. These facilitations are never enough, and Palestinians want a complete end of the siege.
During the clashes, Palestinians burned tires and threw explosives to disturb the Israeli army. The regime soldiers fired live bullets and tear gas at protesters during the nighttime clashes.
Those are not facilitations. The new decisions are simple rights of the Palestinians that the Israeli regime has deprived us of for 50 years. Palestinians are living their worst times ever. While there is no medicine, no food, and we have to take action, all spheres of Gazans are here protesting peacefully, and these protests are ongoing until all the blockade is over.
Palestinians insist on keeping the resistance, starting from nightly confusion to incendiary balloons and clashing with the Israeli regime along the borders. The Israeli regime has not yet kept up with the demands of Palestinians, including ending the crippling blockade. Meanwhile, the resistance confirms that the Israeli new measures are not enough.
These Israeli facilities are not a gift from Israel. There are legal Palestinian rights, and this move shows that the Palestinian outrage forced the Israeli regime to submit to the Palestinian demands partially. Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and their lands, and the resistance will go on until a complete lifting of the siege.
Palestinians here stress that the popular resistance should be held along with the armed resistance until all Palestinian demands are completely achieved. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Dozens of people have been killed in the U.S. northeast as the remnants of Hurricane Ida caused record-breaking rains and flooding. The U.S. east coast faced surging rivers, tornado damage, and continuing calls for rescue on Thursday. In New York City, torrential rains submerged subway lines and grounded airline flights. Recovery efforts are underway to bring back transportation systems. In New Jersey, fire gutted homes in Manville after severe flooding made it impossible for emergency crews to save them. The governors of New York and New Jersey have declared emergencies in their states and urged the residents to stay home. Ida made landfall in Louisiana on Sunday, destroying many homes and leaving millions without electricity. The National Hurricane Center had warned of significant and life-threatening flash flooding in the Mid-Atlantic region and New England. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Washington, White Reed, who gave us more details about the devastation caused by Storm Ida in the U.S.
In New York, authorities are saying that this is predominantly people who were trapped in their vehicles and were unable to escape the floodwaters or were simply washed away trying to escape. Now, this has left tens of thousands of people without power in numerous states, states including New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Mississippi. Louisiana has been particularly hard hit, around 1 million homes and businesses still without power 4 days later. So we're looking at a pretty devastating event all throughout the entirety of the East Coast. People in New York you know, really struggling just as the waters are beginning to recede. People in New Orleans really struggling as no aid is forthcoming, low-income, poor neighborhoods. People really just left to fend for themselves. So, you know, supplies are running out down there as people in New York are being battered by this storm system.
A breakthrough in Venezuelan politics. The main opposition parties have announced they will end their boycotts and participate in elections. Does this mean that Venezuela will finally be able to get back on track and start seeing relief when it comes to things like its economy? This good signal. Another U.S. policy failure that intervening in another country's affairs will not achieve its desired objectives.
Venezuela's main opposition parties have announced an end to 3 years of boycotting elections. The country's opposition alliance, the so-called Democratic Unity Roundtable, which is led by the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido, announced on Tuesday that it would participate in the regional and municipal elections scheduled for November 21. President Nicolas Maduro has praised the move as worthy of applause for returning to democracy. The opposition, however, said its participation would not mean that it believed the elections would be free or fair. The alliance boycotted the 2018 presidential vote, which Maduro won, and the 2020 legislative elections, in which the opposition lost control of Congress. In both cases, it dismissed the elections as fraudulent. Its decision to end the boycott comes as government and opposition representatives are involved in talks, mediated by Norway and hosted by Mexico. The talks, which began last month, are aimed at resolving the political crisis that plagued the Latin American country after Guaido unilaterally declared himself interim president in January 2019.
The Venezuelan political crisis began when Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself the interim president in January 2019 and was recognized by the U.S. as such. And it was during that time when Guaido called for a military uprising. An attempted coup occurred in which Venezuela accused the U.S. of orchestrating Guaido's move from the White House.
Back in 2019, Guaido proclaimed himself the interim president of Venezuela. Back then, the administration of former President Donald Trump, along with several European countries and a number of right-wing Latin American leaders, recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. The U.S. confiscated Venezuelan state assets in America in a bid to support Guaido.
They were doing things that really were undermining the autonomy and the sovereignty of Venezuela to have its own free and fair elections, and were committing acts which they had no right under any sort of international law to do, and so it just is a matter of time before the failure of all these events catches up to the United States and the Venezuelan opposition who was working with them.
The U.S. move was seen as an attempt to topple the legitimate government of Venezuela. That was not the first time the U.S. pushed for regime change in Venezuela. Back in 2002, during the presidency of George W. Bush, a coup was orchestrated against Venezuela's former president, Hugo Chavez. The plot failed due to overwhelming popular support and mobilization against the coup. Washington has a long list of military interventions and coups in different Latin American countries. Venezuela is now one of the few countries in that region which is led by a left-wing anti-imperialist government. The U.S. push to oust Maduro's government is reminiscent of U.S. colonial moves in Latin America during the 20th century. The Food Assistance Agency of the UN has estimated that one out of every three Venezuelans is struggling to consume enough daily calories.
The UK has registered 178 more coronavirus-related deaths, raising its overall fatalities to more than 133,000. UK officials also confirmed over 38,000 new infections over the past day. The figure pushes the overall COVID caseload in the country to more than 6.8 million. Britain has been reporting a steady increase in deaths among those testing positive, for COVID-19 since lockdown restrictions were lifted in mid-July. Scientists have warned that infection rates will rise again following the reopening of schools. Around 500,000 people around the world who have weakened immune system are to be offered a third COVID-19 jab, while the majority of people from low-income countries have still not received their first dose. Ahmed Cabello has more with this report from London.
We are all in this together has been the slogan echoed repeatedly throughout the COVID-19 global health pandemic. But time and time again, it's been proven to be little more than intelligent brand marketing, as a global health crisis has laid bare not only the inequalities within societies, but also on the global stage. In Africa, considered the most resource-rich continent on the planet, but the poorest in terms of GDP, less than 2% of the continent's population of 1.3 billion has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. While in comparison, in the European Union, 70% of adults have now been fully vaccinated, according to EU officials, leading to allegations of COVID apartheid in the international arena.
Some countries are now rolling out booster doses to fully vaccinated people when millions of people around the world have not even received their first dose.
Israel has provided 1 million Israelis their third dose, while only 18% of Palestinians in Gaza have received only one dose of the COVID vaccine.
Meanwhile, the UK, a former colonial power in Africa, is the latest to offer a third dose of the COVID vaccine to around 500,000 Brits. At a time when Africa is experiencing 248,000 new confirmed cases just last week, and 28 African countries are in the midst of a surge in infections driven by the new Delta variant.
And today we're going to go a step further by accepting the advice of the independent JCVI that anyone that is severely immunosuppressed should be offered a third dose.
According to research conducted by the Zoe COVID study, effectiveness in the Pfizer vaccine was at 88% after 1 month, but dropped to 74% after 6 months. And for AstraZeneca, the effectiveness of the vaccine was 77% after 1 month, but dropped to 67% after 4 to 5 months. This arguably demonstrates the need for third booster jabs. However, in low-income countries where there are fewer healthcare workers, weaker infrastructure, and poor access to COVID vaccines, that need is far greater. But their cry for help has thus far been ignored by the very powers that told us we are all in this together. Ahmed Cabello, London.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Americans, like the British and the Soviets before them, dug their own graveyard in Afghanistan. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Chris Hedges, writer. This article is published under the heading, A Vengeful American Empire Has Been Humiliated in Afghanistan. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Imperial powers do not forgive those who expose their weaknesses or make public the sordid and immoral inner workings of empire. Empires are fragile constructions. Their power is as much one of perception as of military strength. The virtues they claim to uphold and defend, usually in the name of their superior civilization, are a mask for pillage, the exploitation of cheap labor, indiscriminate violence, and state terror. The current American empire, damaged and humiliated by the truths of internal documents published by WikiLeaks, will, for this reason, persecute Julian Assange for the rest of his life. It does not matter who is president or which political party is in power. Imperialists speak with one voice. The Taliban, which defeated U.S. and coalition forces in a 20-year war, is about to be confronted with the wrath of a wounded empire. The faux pity for the Afghan people, which has defined the coverage of the desperate collaborators with the U.S. and coalition occupying forces and educated elites fleeing to Kabul airport, begins and ends with the plight of the evacuees. There were few tears shed for the families routinely terrorized by coalition forces or the some 70,000 civilians who were obliterated by U.S. airstrikes, drone attacks, missiles, and artillery, or gunned down by nervous occupying forces who saw every Afghan with some justification as the enemy during the war. And there will be few tears for the administration and humanitarian catastrophe the empire is orchestrating on the 38 million Afghans who live in one of the poorest and most aid-dependent countries in the world. Since the 2001 invasion, the United States deployed about 775,000 military personnel to subdue Afghanistan and poured $143 billion into the country, with 60% of the money going to prop up the corrupt military and the rest devoted to funding economic development projects, aid programs, and anti-drug initiatives, with the bulk of those funds being siphoned off by foreign aid groups, private contractors, and outside consultants. Grants from the U.S. and other countries accounted for 75% of the Afghan government budget. That assistance has evaporated. Afghanistan's reserves and other financial accounts have been frozen, meaning the new government cannot access some $9.5 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank. Shipments of cash to Afghanistan have been stopped. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, announced that Afghanistan will no longer be able to access the lender's resources. Things are already dire. There are some 14 million Afghans, one in three, who lack sufficient food. There are 2 million Afghan children who are malnourished. There are 3.5 million people in Afghanistan who have been displaced from their homes. The war has wrecked infrastructure. A drought destroyed 40% of Afghanistan crops last year. The assault on the Afghan economy is already seeing food prices skyrocket. The sanctions and severance of aid will force civil servants to go without salaries and the health service. Already chronically short of medicine and equipment will collapse. The suffering orchestrated by the U.S. empire will be of biblical proportions. And this is what the empire wants. These warlords have done the bidding of the Americans before. They will do the bidding of the Americans again. And since the hovery of empire is unaffected by reality, the empire will continue to sow dragon's teeth in Afghanistan, as it has since it spent $9 billion, some estimates double that figure, to back the fighters that fought the Soviets, leading to a bloody civil war between rivals warlords. Once the Soviets withdrew in 1989 and the ascendancy in 1996 of the Taliban. The cynicism of arming and funding the fighters against the Soviets exposes the lie of America's humanitarian concerns in Afghanistan. 1 million Afghan civilians were killed in the 9-year conflict with the Soviets, along with 90,000 fighters, 18,000 Afghan troops, and 14,500 Soviet soldiers. All empires die. The end is usually unpleasant. The American empire humiliated in Afghanistan, as it was in Syria, Iraq, and Libya, as it was at the Bay of Pigs and in Vietnam, is blind to its own declining strength, ineptitude, and savagery. Its entire economy, military, revolves around the war industry. Military spending and war are the engine behind the United States' economic survival and identity. It does not matter that with each new debacle, the United States turns larger and larger parts of the globe against it and all it claims to represent. It has no mechanism to stop itself despite its numerous defeats, fiascos, blunders, and diminishing power from striking out irrationally like a wounded animal. The Soviet Union collapsed, like all empires, because of its ossified, out-of-touch rulers, its imperial overreach, and its inability to critique and reform itself. The United States regime is not immune from these fatal diseases. If the empire was capable of introspection and forgiveness, it could free itself from its death spiral. If the empire disbanded, much as the British Empire did, and retreated to focus on the ills that beset the United States, it could free itself from its death spiral. But those who manipulate the levers of empire are unaccountable. They are hidden from public view and beyond public scrutiny. They are determined to keep playing the great game, rolling the dice with lives and national treasure. They will preside gleefully over the deaths of even more affluents, assuring themselves it is worth it, without realizing that the gallows they erect are for themselves.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. Brought to you by Arab English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting Brother Sayyid Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so very much for joining us, Sayyid. Assalamu alaikum, bro.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for introducing me. Habib Zata,
yes,
at your service.
Today, since we're recording this during the month of Muharram, I want to ask you guys about ignorance. I think is one of the main streaks of every human being, right? It's like one of our innate qualities. And no matter how much knowledge we acquire, we still possess a level of ignorance. And that happens to apply to almost every field of our lives, including in relation with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. One of the most obvious and apparent dimensions in which we express our blatant ignorance toward Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is how we mourn him. I'm not saying that our gatherings are ignorant. I'm saying we express a lot of ignorance in the method, in the manner of our mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. I feel that it could and should be more intellectual.
There's no doubt that when you look at people themselves, people are not equal. You have, you know, different levels of people. You have people who are generally go to the majalis of Imam Hussein alayhi salam out of the sheer love for Imam Hussein. Some of them, they go because they want to get something more,
like
right?
What?
So they want, you know, they want some intellectual, for example, lecture or something
some
that, yeah, so
right.
Some of them are in tuned to the majalis spiritually, some of them emotionally, some of them intellectually.
Mm-mm.
But to generalize them and call it ignorance,
no, I'm not generalizing nothing.
Okay.
I'm saying
all
that
right.
It's one of those arenas where we show
now,
ignorance.
Okay, I have to admit that a lot of things happen under the name of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
By people who mm-hmm. are who have love for Imam Hussein, which these things we consider them to be ignorant actions.
Yep.
All right. So there's no doubt about that.
If you look
what
do you think is one of those examples?
It's hard.
Was
to
that an awkward question?
No, it's not an awkward question. It's hard to put a finger on because anything that I can bring an example of, there are a lot of people doing it correctly. So
like
if
what?
I
now I'm confused.
For example, okay, if we go to the majalis, for example,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, chest beating for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We all do it. You know, we feel sad and sorrow for the Imam. We beat our chest. Some of them, for example, they go extra mile.
Yeah,
it
they
becomes,
strip down.
I was watching a clip today. They were doing a dance, a literal dance.
Yeah,
it's not even Latum anymore. Like they jump with a stone and they hit. I'm like, okay, now you're taking out of context, right? Now you're just giving Imam Hussein a bad name. Beating your chest is a good thing. Do it. But don't invent things,
yes,
right? So,
I
for
agree.
Example, when it comes to the mawakib as well, you provide services to people, but sometimes when it becomes a little bit too much and people act, I've seen like really shocking clips, right? Or the people, the way they dress. And even when they do the tamathil for the imams, alayhi salam, on the treasure of Karbala, it's good, right? But some of the people that act, they do things like, I was watching people like doing crazy stuff. what, you know, trying to reenact an event.
Mm.
So that is
speaking of reenacting events.
That's definitely, there's an ignorance there. So okay, we're saying it's a good thing, do it, right? Mm. But it has to, you know, be under,
be suitable for this sacred occasion.
Yeah.
You can't do whatever you want and then label it with, oh, love and devotion for Aba Abdullah.
The intention of every person going to the majlis, or every person wanting to go to those gatherings,
mm,
I think it's very important. And it really, and every believer has different intentions. They might differ in the levels of the power of faith and, you know, their certainty and knowledge about Aba Abdullah and Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So, for example, when you go with the intention of, I don't have dinner tonight, so I'm going to go to the majlis and I will eat there.
Mm.
That's one kind of intention.
Mm.
Could be available is that I want to go and cry. Mm. Fatima, and wawasli Rasulillah, to help Fatima salawatullah alayha to cry and to connect with the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Then you have also people who want to gain knowledge, and the examples you brought up, Sayyid Abdullah.
Mm.
So what makes it ignorance?
Ignorant.
I think that,
there are
that's what we should talk about more.
I think you might have gotten stuck on the ignorant side of things. So what we're trying to say here is, like, if you look at any event, it doesn't matter whether it's Ashura or non-Ashura or something Islamic or non-Islamic.
There are suitable things and unsuitable things,
there
right?
Are people, when it comes to certain things, they would make a joke out of it, right? I mean, their intention is pure, right? Let's say their intention is good. I want to attend. For example, I come here, you guys sitting here, I want to have a debate. But then it clicks in my head. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to joke about it. I'm just going to try to be funny, try to be cool, try to be awesome. And then I would throw it out of context, right? With Imam Hussein alayhi salam, everyone has, like you said, everyone has an intention to come to this majalis. But then somewhere along the road, they do something, and that's something that is bad. That's what we label ignorance. See what I mean?
And also,
so we don't say, oh, people are ignorant for attending a majalis, or, you know, there are ignorant people coming to the majalis. No. When it comes to the majalis, when it comes to the way we do things, you can't overlook the fact that
it's something gets lost along the way.
That's actually my question. Mm. What makes the thing ignorance? Because when you look at the people, the kuffar of Quraysh, when they entered Islam, forcefully, they had to submit to Islam, actually, with the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. They were making fun of the adhan. They were making fun of Hajj. We even have the story about those atheists were sitting down, and they used to sit down and watch the people go around the Kaaba and make fun of them. Mm-hmm. And they used to make fun of them in front of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam would, you know, stand up to it. So at the end of the day, each action that we do, every action that we do, it has a soul. Let's call it a soul. Mm. It has a reality to it. It has a background to it.
That
was that context that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if it remains on that context, it's not an ignorant act. Now, this is like what we call in Mantaq the Kubra. Come to the Sughra, to the smaller, you know, preface. What are the examples? What are the correct examples? Like you stated, for those who are moving or hitting their heads with rocks.
No. Not hitting themselves with rocks.
What are they doing?
Like, I mean, look. There are people that hit themselves with rocks. There are people who hit themselves against the wall. There are people literally put glass through their heads. There are people who walk on fire. There are a lot of action that happens under the azza of Imam Hussein.
Mm.
That's what we call ignorance. Do you know how we call it ignorance? Because if Imam Hussein alayhi salam was here, would he allow it? Would Sahab al-Zaman salamullah alayhi allow it? Would they call this an act of the people they want them to follow?
And
right?
How
so,
is
Kunu
that?
Zainan lana, alayna, right?
What does that mean?
Be good, like a good example for us, not a bad example. Because Imam Sadiq says, when they said to him, are you Shia? He said, ma aqalla man, if I remember the hadith correctly, he said, ma aqalla man hum man yattaba' Ja'far ibn Muhammad. Like,
means?
How little are those who actually follow Ja'far ibn Muhammad? If you want to follow us, follow in our example. Mm-hmm. These majalis, like I said, we have certain actions that we hold close, and we call them Aza of Abu Abdullah, like beating the chest, holding them, jealous, crying, and all these things. These are sacred to us. But when someone comes and makes a mockery out of it, because they have the intention, like you said, they have the intention, but they make a mockery out of it. Now, that's an ignorant
action.
Yes,
and it's out of ignorance,
right?
Because they don't know any better.
Excuse me, but you are stating that this is something that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam do not accept. You're stating that Imam Hussein, if he was available, he would not accept.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that?
How do I know that? That's his seerah. His seerah was based on the fact that he was doing an uprising. He took his family and he got slaughtered in such a manner to do what? So people could hit themselves on the wall and
okay,
rocks.
Okay, thank you so very much, gentlemen. You're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back after a short break, so don't go anywhere.
شهیدان تو یا حسین، آه ار سر خان تو یا حسین، آه دلم اسرت کربلا، آه کربلا کربلا کربلا،
thank you so very much for being with us on Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have two very special guests, Brother Habib and Brother Abdullah. We're talking about ignorance and mourning Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. Now, that does not mean that mourning Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam is an act of ignorance. Rather, ignorant people who attend the majalis and the ignorant expressions of sorrow for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Here's the thing about ignorance, like all other things, it's got levels. I've got a level of ignorance.
I wouldn't agree with you.
You've got a level of
the terminology,
Brother Habib. As strange and outlandish as this may sound to you, you have a level of ignorance. I know that comes as news, but it's the truth.
Now, but the thing is, like, I would stop you there. You said ignorant people attend the majalis. I don't believe there's anyone who attends the majalis is ignorant. Anyone who attends the majalis for Abu Abdullah, he comes out of love. He comes with an intention to this majalis.
But they're still.
Here's the thing. I wouldn't call them ignorant for attending the majalis. I would say that if they do something that contradicts the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam or what the majlis is meant to be, that's an act of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't like label them to begin with as ignorant. You said ignorant people come
to
the majalis.
They're not ignorant for going to the majalis, Sayyid, but they are ignorant people as individuals. Some people are just downright ignorant.
No,
we're talking about specific kind of ignorance.
Yes, specific kind of ignorance.
And that's like Abdullah's removing it. I agree with actually what he's saying, that when that person is going, he's going with a clean intention. Let's call it a pure intention, right? Yes, what you guys are trying to say, you two, not me, you two are trying to say is that they have a level of ignorance. So their ignorance is in expression for their sorrow of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. That's what you guys are trying to say, right?
Yeah.
Good. So I made you guys agree. Like, I want to defend, before we went to the break, Sayyid Abdullah was stating that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam have a message. Of course, let's accept that the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and if we agree with it, that it was an uprise or whatever, and it wasn't
a
kind
of
oppression
thing.
Towards
No. Here's for the listeners, right? I feel like I need to state it because they can't see us. Brother Habib, every time he talks about uprising, he does that air quote because he doesn't believe in it as an uprising. Brother Habib, why don't you explain to us, just for background, for context?
The movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was oppression towards Muhammad and Ali Muhammad.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the summary of it. And what happened to Imam Hussein alayhi salam was dhulum on the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and anything available in history books that was called uprise, it was used by the Umayyad historians to make the killing of Imam Hussein alayhi salam reasonable. That's just my point of view. But going to your point of view, Imam Hussein alayhi salam had a movement, right? At the end of the day, true, there is this message that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam have, that us Shia should be something, you know, as a message for the rest of the people. We should be messengers with our actions, not only with our tongues. One of the things that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam always advise their Shia, always recommend to their Shia followers, is that to always be in sorrow towards Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. There is no denying
that
something so sacred, so holy. So this sorrowness that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam want us to have is to, there are a couple of benefits, but there's this connection that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam want us to gain and use the path of Imam Hussein alayhi salam as a path to gain that connection. The way that we express sorrow, why do you limit it? What's the limitation? How do you
matter? It's not limitation. I'll give you an example. Ahlul Bayt salamullah alayhim, even when it came to the sorrows, and it came when they instructed their followers to mourn for them, they set the criteria. Now, anything, you can go extravagant. We have like
extreme,
right? So I could recite the Quran in a singing voice. That's haram. You can't say to me, why are you limiting my tongue? Because it's haram. When it comes to the Azab Ahl Bayt, let me just
there's a reason
point.
For limitation.
You just
yeah,
said why?
Yeah, why? What's the reason of limitation? My question is, what's the reason of limitation for the way that the methods that we show our sorrow. There are some people who like to cut themselves.
You want to answer is why, clearly why, because it goes against the Ahl al-Bayt what they want. For example, let me give you example. Have you listened to the Latmiyat in Iraq?
Look, I'm not talking.
Have you seen the video clip that they make for these things?
True. If it goes,
it's just insane. It's insanity. It's not just a matter of whether Ahl al-Bayt accepted or not or limited. Insanity. Do latum, do aza, do nawha and musibah for Ahl al-Bayt alayhi salam. But don't do it in a way where the Ahl al-Bayt, they themselves, they say, well, that's something I don't want myself.
When did they set this criteria, Sayyidina?
The criteria are available. Yeah, I agree with you, Sayyidina. Mm-hmm. There's like these principles she talked about. For example, singing. The prohibition of singing, for example.
Mm.
Using it in the maddahi. True. Hurting yourself to a point where you might die. Forbidden. But if it doesn't have these, you know, forbidden limitations and what...
But we're not talking about these ones who are within limits. We're talking about the ones who've done
outside of limits. Yeah, okay, that's my fault for going into examples.
Gentlemen, there shouldn't be ignorance because Ahl al-Bayt alayhi salam set a criteria for us. That's all the time we have for today's show. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Back to Reality. Until another episode, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
شهیدان تو یا حسین آه ار سر خان تو یا حسین آه
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan. The lies have come from the White House, Congress, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA, as well as from Hollywood, cable news pundits, journalists, and the broader culture, says James Reason, writer, in an article titled... For two decades, Americans told one lie after another about what they were doing in Afghanistan. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. For 20 years, America essentially ran a narco state in Afghanistan. During the initial invasion and bombing campaign in 2001, the Bush administration ignored the drug problem, believing that it was a distraction from America's main counterterrorism mission and refused to bomb drug-related facilities. The U.S. spent nearly $9 billion on its token counter-narcotics programs in Afghanistan, yet opium production and heroin smuggling in Afghanistan skyrocketed under the U.S.-backed regime. Afghanistan now produces more than 80% of the world's heroin supply. Afghanistan's opium production soared in 2002 and just kept growing. By 2020, 224,000 hectares of land were under opium poppy cultivation in Afghanistan, compared with 123,000 hectares in 2010, according to the United Nations. The U.S. provided $145 billion over 20 years to rebuild a country that had a gross domestic product of just $19 billion in 2019. As recently as 2018, nearly 80% of Afghan government spending came from Western donors. The combined effects of the massive flows of Western aid dollars funding for combat operations and the river of narco dollars created a surreal economic bubble in Afghanistan. A new Western-style urban professional class sprang up in Kabul, many of whose members are now fleeing the Taliban. But the money also triggered an epidemic of corruption and insider dealing that thoroughly discredited both the Afghan central government and the United States regime. Much of the American money enriched U.S. contractors without ever entering the Afghan economy. Much of it also disappeared into secret bank accounts in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, held by Afghan government officials, warlords, and their families. A phenomenon described in a 2020 report by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace as the cross-pollination of criminality between Afghanistan and Dubai. Meanwhile, petty corruption, bribes to local officials to obtain any service or job, was endemic, stoking more resentment against the government among average Afghans. The UN found that by 2012, Afghans were paying $3.9 million in bribes per year. Half of all Afghans paid a bribe for a public service. As the U.S.-backed government continued, petty bribery and corruption grew worse, not better. Militias were using their position and closeness with the government and U.S. military to control roads, secure lucrative contracts, establish themselves as regional powers, and sometimes serve both sides, cooperating with both international and Taliban forces to maximize profits, concluded a 2018 report from the Institute of World Politics. The government-fueled bribery and corruption forced many Afghans into the arm of the Taliban, who gained the reputation of settling financial and other disputes using more straightforward, if far more brutal, methods. Trying to compete with the Taliban's dispute resolution would have meant allowing laws, and that's not something we could do politically. Barnett Robin, a longtime Afghanistan expert who advised the State Department, told the Special Inspector General. Perhaps the most cynical decision in the war in Afghanistan was taken by Obama in 2009. During the 2008 presidential campaign, Obama sought to distinguish himself from his main political rivals with his emphatic denunciations of the war in Iraq. Fearful of being attacked from the right for being too dovish, Obama balanced his attacks on the Iraq war by claiming that he would do more than the Bush administration had done to win the war in Afghanistan. In 2009, Obama announced that he was escalating U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan, his ill-considered Afghan surge. The surge came with no real long-term strategy, and it is hard not to see Obama's decision as little more than a political calculation to live up to his earlier campaign promise, which had only been made to insulate him from attacks on his position on Iraq. As American troops flowed steadily into Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010, combat operations were focused on the south, notably Helmand Province, a stronghold of both the Taliban and opium production. U.S. troop levels peaked at about 100,000 during the surge, the highest levels of the entire war in Afghanistan. But the surge quickly descended into an inconclusive war of attrition. U.S. casualties reached their highest levels of the war during the surge, with fatalities rising to 496 in 2010. Obama drew down U.S. forces to around 8,400 by the time he left office. Donald Trump came into the presidency in 2017, having campaigned on a vow to end America's forever wars. He was determined to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan, but he was easily distracted by cronies eager to make money. Eric Prince, the infamous founder of Blackwater, nearly convinced Trump to let him take over the entire combat mission in Afghanistan by using paid mercenaries instead of U.S. troops. Instead, Trump got so sidetracked that he let the Pentagon talk him into increasing troop levels at about 14,000 in 2017. Trump finally got his way in February 2020 when the U.S. and the Taliban signed an agreement setting the conditions for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 1, 2021. After the 2020 presidential election, Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller announced that U.S. troop levels had been reduced to 2,500. Joe Biden came into office this year, making the case that after 20 years, the war in Afghanistan had to end. Getting out of Afghanistan was perhaps the only issue on which he publicly agreed with Donald Trump. On April 14th, he announced that all U.S. troops would be withdrawn by September 11th, 2021, the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Trump promptly criticized Biden for failing to meet the May 1st deadline he had negotiated with the Taliban, saying that we can and should get out earlier, and that getting out of Afghanistan is a wonderful and positive thing to do. I plan to withdraw on May 1st, and we should keep as close to that schedule as possible, unquote. The Taliban also issued a statement in April criticizing Biden for failing to meet the agreed-upon deadline. They warned ominously that the delay opens the way for the Taliban to take every necessary countermeasure. In an interview with the Special Inspector General, Douglas Lute, who coordinated strategy for Afghanistan at the National Security Council from 2007 to 2013, gave a brief and devastating critique of the American enterprise in Afghanistan. Lute said, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing."
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.